Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vesta Goddars, and Carl Mixer. And to our camera crew, John Randolph, Kieran Meadows, Anna Osbeck, and Matt Ealing. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. You are listening to 90.7 KBOO Portland. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time. At 10 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein visits with the Sightline Institute to look at Tacoma, Washington, and that community's fight to stop fossil fuel development in the Northwest. At 11, Economic Updates Labor Day Special with Richard Wolf talking about the exploding pay gap, the DNC's acceptance of fossil fuel donations, and capitalism versus socialism. At 11:30, Madness Radio interviews theoretical physicist Fritjof Capra about what the study of living systems can teach us about mental health care. But next, it's More Talk Radio with guest host Linda Olsen Osterlund, talking labor and taking your calls. All these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on donate.
I've seen my light come shine.
In 1967, Bob Dylan and several members of what became The Band got together in upstate New York. For months, they played and recorded. Join Rita Houston as she talks to band members about that time and samples some of the musical gems that are in the complete basement tapes. All right here on the Singer-Songwriter edition of the Monday Sampler, September 3rd at 2 p.m.
Are we gonna set down in the Giza chair?
Have you wondered what volunteering at KBOO is like? Do you want to get more involved with your community radio station? KBOO's Fall Membership Drive begins Thursday, September 6th, and runs through Saturday, September 22nd. We need volunteers to answer the phone lines throughout the drive. You can make a huge difference with your participation, helping listeners become members. It's a great way to support KBOO while getting a behind-the-scenes view of how we work at our busiest time. Email Ani at volunteer@kboo.org or call 503-231-8032, extension 213, to find shifts that work for your schedule. Thank you for supporting KBOO Portland.
Hi, this is Jim Hightower. Whenever I'm in Portland, I get my daily dose of local, national, and world news from KBOO, Portland Community Radio at its finest. And don't miss my commentaries weekdays during the KBOO Evening News.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio this Labor Day morning. I'm your host for More Talk Radio this morning, Linda Olsen Osterlund. Our usual hosts, Cecil and Celeste, are off. They'll be back, I believe, next week, and so you'll be happy to have them back. And today you've got me. We're going to talk about Labor Day. Labor Day, a day that has been designated a holiday in honor of workers. There is another holiday that was in honor of international workers, and that's May Day, as many of you know, or International Workers' Day. But today it's a Labor Day holiday. Some of you are off work as a benefit of your work. Some of you are off work because you don't have any work. And some of you are probably going to head off to work. If you're in any of the many service jobs, as I was, often holidays weren't holidays for you, but maybe busier times of work. Though I do notice my favorite coffee shop and some other businesses, especially the local smaller ones, do take the day off in honor of their own workers. Today, I want to hear from you. I want to hear from you about your own work experience or stories of labor that inspire and excite you. Maybe a time when you were on strike as a union worker somewhere, or maybe just what you've learned over the many years of the different kinds of jobs you do. I want to hear from you. The number to call is 503-231-8187. You're going to hear, I think there's going to be a really great show at 11 here, Economic Updates of Labor Day Special. You're going to hear a lot of numbers and statistics and information about wage gaps, and I do have some of that for you here, and I will be happy to fill you in on that, but I really want to talk stories of work. Sometimes we forget about those stories, and I'm going to start with a story in history, and it's about a woman named Mother Jones. Maybe you've seen the magazine Mother Jones, and you think that when I say Mother Jones, maybe you don't think anything when you hear it, but she was a very interesting woman, a really important woman in the struggle for labor in this country. She came from, she looked like a little old lady with white hair and little tiny glasses and wearing a tight neck black garb, but she came to the United States as an immigrant from running from the Irish famines as a child, and she grew up in first in Canada and then in the United States, and became a skilled seamstress and a worker of that sort. And in her early 20s, she moved down to Memphis, Tennessee, and got married to a man named George Jones and had four children. And then the yellow fever hit. This is the kind of disease we don't see very often anymore in this nation or around in much of the world. And that's good, because it took her whole family within a couple days. Her husband and her four children were dead. Following that, she left that and went back to Chicago, where she'd worked as a seamstress before, and she became a seamstress for very wealthy families. And here's what she had to say began to turn her into a union activist, though her husband had been a strong unionist as well. She said, "I would look out the plate glass windows of the rich and see the poor, shivering wretches, jobless and hungry, walking alongside the frozen lakefront." She said, "The topical contrast of their condition with that of the topical comfort of the people for whom I sewed was painful to me. My employers seemed neither to notice nor to care." She went on to become an organizer all across the nation. She became famous for her oratories and spoke at many strikes and many different organizing movements of workers. And in June 1897, she was addressing a railway union convention. And after that, she began to be referred to as Mother by the men of the union, the mother of the unions. Well, she organized all over, but in 1903, she did one of the most exciting things that I ever heard about, which was she took the mill working children, the children who were crippled from their work in labor, and she started a march. I believe it was a march that went all the way across the nation, but I'm not remembering. But she started a march of these to bring attention to child labor. It was probably one of the most pivotal images that forced people to realize the horrors of child labor in this country and begin to have some changes made. So that's our Mother Jones, and I would dedicate the whole show to this little old lady with the power of a lion, and for the people. And it's moved by, I think, her own life as a human being, just knowing the hardships that people could pass. I do believe we have one caller already, and I'd love to have you on. Let's hear. Julie, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. I'm glad we're having this this topic today, of course. So two stories, and they're both about Sears, working at Sears.
Okay.
As a college student way back in the late 60s, I was working Christmas holiday special put on for temporary. Anyway, I was doing mostly float work, and after a short while, they had me closing and doing some other things as well. But what I wanted to share was a story about covering. Often I would cover for various departments when they took their lunch breaks. And I was in the sporting goods. I didn't know anything about pool tables. But right after the people left and I was in charge of the department, somebody wanted to buy a pool table, and they had their big, thick catalog right there. So we looked at the good, better, best pool tables and talked about them, and the fellow basically sold it himself, just looking at the different options. And so I sold a really super pool table, and I knew how to write it up and have it delivered when he drove around and everything. And I did that and took about 20, 30 minutes. And then I wasn't really doing anything else for the rest of the time. And the guys come back from their lunch break and say, anything happened? I said, no, it's been pretty quiet. Didn't have very many people. Okay, da-da-da-da. They looked through the book and they said, you sold a pool table? I said, oh yeah, I did. You know that we get a huge commission for selling pool tables, and you just get your little hourly wage for selling pool. How dare you sell a pool table while we're away? Da 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 da. So I was banned from covering sporting goods for the rest of the time I was there.
No congratulations there, was there?
No, not at all. And not anything from the, you know, the store that I'm doing a good job of everything that I was supposed to learn and do. And so that's one thing about Sears. The other thing about Sears that maybe people in the U.S. don't know is Sears has just pulled out of Canada. All the people who work for Sears and who were getting retirement checks and that sort of thing, when they pulled out, everything stopped. So whatever anybody did that was supposed to continue because of their work for Sears, and many people spent a whole career at Sears in Canada, that's just stopped. Sears pulled out, and everything else attached to them pulled out as well. So that's been something that's been very difficult for many, many people there to deal with, but it's just how things were. And I'm just thinking about our own companies, too, brick-and-mortar companies that people think they have, stake in even after they retire and things like that. And don't think you do, because they can just pull out and not be there. I know that a lot of the airline companies and things, too, people lost retirements and things when...
Yeah, that was under Reagan, when Reagan said, too bad to air controllers, yeah.
Right.
And that was also too bad to all of us, because it said that they could break pensions, that they could throw them out. Even though you couldn't get back your labor, they could take back their money.
Right. But I'm just saying it even affects other countries, too. So.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you very much. How long did you stay at Sears?
Well, they kept me on past the Christmas season to the time where we were doing inventory, because they wanted me to help with that. I was a good worker. They liked me there, but then I guess I worked there for about 6 months.
Yeah, okay. And I know about temporary work myself.
One other short thing. Every time I ever shop at Sears, they always say, would I like a credit card? And I always say, you know, when I worked at Sears way back then, I asked for a credit card because I thought, you know, here I was in college and I was working for Sears. I appreciated what I was doing there. But they said, no, I wasn't making enough money to qualify for their credit cards.
And they said
even
that was...
though I was working for them. And so anytime now I'm retired and I'm making good money and everything. But people say, you know, oh, would you like a credit card? I say, sit down. I'm going to tell you why I do not want a credit card. And all these young people asking me naively, and then they have to hear my story, but that's okay. It lives on.
Yes, I'm glad they have to hear your story, as a matter of fact. And, you know, there's all sorts of ways that, you know, young people get taken advantage of in jobs. I know stores like, I won't say for sure it was Abercrombie and Fitch, but I believe it was, but stores like that have high, you know, expensive fashions for young people got in trouble for making their young people have to buy a new outfit out of their wages for every season and wear that to work. You know, and there goes all their wages. There goes all that work. Well, thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate it.
Thank you for your show.
Yeah, thank you. I want to let other people know we want to hear from you. It's 503-231-8187. And right now we don't have anybody else on the line. So I'll tell you one of my work stories. I'll tell you when I first started work. I'm relatively old, so I've had many jobs. I also moved around a lot. So my first job that we could call, that I think of as a job, was I bottle picked. Just like we see so many people in my neighborhood, I live in Inner Southeast, going down behind the houses and in the alleys, getting bottles and cans and anything else really that can be sold usefully. And there's many people with big carts and little carts, and even one of my neighbors who does wonderful gardens says it's one of the ways he handles his insomnia. He gets up and he goes bottle picking. So I did that when I was, 11 and 12 years old. I had a good friend who had a wagon. She's the one who introduced me to this. This was in Norman, Oklahoma, where my mother was going to college. And we would go between the hedge and the dorm. So all the dorms and the University of, or actually they called it Oklahoma University, all the dorms had these giant hedges beside them, and all the students apparently drank and threw their bottles out those dorm windows, so they were behind the hedge. And we would go walking with her wagon and behind them and gather up all the bottles and cans. I don't think we had cans. I don't remember canned pop then. It was pretty much all bottles. And so we would gather up all those bottles and go to a nearby store and turn them in. Now, I wasn't having to do this to have food on the table. We were poor, but we always had food on the table and you know, clothes that weren't really rags and all of that kind of thing. So I was doing this because there was no other way for us to get any money for entertainment. And so I would use my change every weekend with my best friend. We would buy comics and True Detective magazines and candy and pop and have enough left over to go see one really heart-wrenching movie. And so that was my first way of really earning my way in life. And I really loved the experience of doing that, by the way. It was fun with my friend, but I also liked getting the money and all that candy and reading. So that was my very first job. We have some other callers on the line now. I believe. Deanna. Good morning, Deanna. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, Linda, thank you for the show. I just listened to Democracy Now, as you may have, and to the interview with Boots Riley, the hip-hop artist and maker of this very interesting film. Sorry to bother you. And I wondered, had you seen it, or maybe some other people listening have, and it is certainly a film worth discussing on Labor Day.
Would you say a little bit more about it? I did not get to hear Democracy Now. Unfortunately, when you do a morning talk show, you usually are doing preparation at the same time
right.
It's on, so I have to listen to it again later. So right. Tell us what the Sorry to Bother You is about and what it impressed you.
Well, I am not really prepared to give a synopsis of it, but it's a story of workers in Oakland that is created by Boots Riley, of specifically a black worker who goes to work in one of these big box places. It's a call center, hundreds of people answering phones, and about what the oppression is like there and how he is encouraged to sound like a white person so that he can do these sales over the phone. And it's very entertaining, but with a terrific biting edge to it, obviously. And then the rest of it is about what he does about that and what everybody else does and how they, you know, the choices he has to make when he gets pushed upstairs because he does so well, sounding
yes,
like a white
yes.
person, right? And how that divides him from the rest of the people and on and on. But it's a terrific film to see, and it certainly is a Labor Day film par excellence. And maybe other people who are listening now will call in and give their opinion about it, but I just thought it great to mention it today.
Yeah, good.
So thank you.
You know, I've been waiting for a show about call centers because, I mean, there was the one about, I'm not remembering the name of it right now, that took place in Mumbai. But that call center looked very different from the call centers I've worked in here in the United States. And I have worked in two call centers, both for local Oregon companies. One was Pendleton and one was Hannah Anderson. And so call centers would be great for a comedy on TV because they seem absurd at much of the time. Many of you may not know, but you know, if you're sitting there on the phone answering the phone, you have a script in front of you and you have to take people through that script, and you have so much time. I believe my time at one of my places was 3 minutes and 15 seconds for the whole phone call. And heaven forbid that you be someone who talks a little longer or get someone who's wordy, because they will come around. And if you start not matching that call time, you will hear about it. You will come in and meet with them. They will try to discuss with you what kinds of issues are there, why you can't get your call down to 3 minutes and 15 seconds. And it sounds ridiculous, you know, and when you go in, and most of these jobs are just, if they're paying just a teeny bit over minimum, a little bit over minimum. And if you're lucky and you're not just temporary, which many of the call center jobs are temporary based on seasons, like, you know, the catalog business for Christmas starts sometime in August, I swear, and fall, and they start rolling out all of that. So you'll have a seasonal job, but it's they're not well paid, and they often have people in supervisory positions that are kind of power tripping. And want to tell you, it reminded me of the movies where about workers, where there was one where one man would always whisper under his breath, "I could burn this place down if I wanted to. I could burn this place down if I wanted to." It was very hard not to have similar feelings working in call centers. So thank you for bringing up that movie, and I'm going to look forward to it. Do we have another caller on the line now? Lou, welcome to KBOO this morning, Lou.
So it sounds like you're talking about workers, call centers, and movies.
Yeah, so far it's Labor Day, and we're talking stories about labor as opposed to statistics. So I have some lists of statistics here if you want them.
Well, I had a comment on two or three thoughts, but one was part of the story with, I did get to listen to Amy's program, and the film is getting really good reviews. Sorry to bother you, film. Part of the shtick with it is, and it's fiction and it's magical realism, but the black worker who's the main character is encouraged to use his white voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I happen to have just seen Spike Lee's film where exactly the same device is used. And you may have seen Spike Lee's film already, Black Klansman.
No, but I'm dying to. There's a couple theaters near me that have it, and I've seen him talk about it, and I've seen some clips from it. I like Spike Lee films anyway, and I would want to see this.
Sure. Yeah, well, Black Klansman surprised me because, I saw that perhaps the same interview you did, Spike Lee talked about, when he first heard the story, which is a true story about a black cop, the first cop hired in Colorado Springs, it's a true story, basically infiltrated the Klan, but the way they did it was he used his white voice on the phone, and then a white cop went in as the same name to infiltrate the Klan. The things that surprised me was it kind of is traditional Spike Lee, the first hour, but then it becomes, one review said, I think A.O. Scott from the New York Times, his best film since his big film, Do the Right Thing. Because the last half of it is, there's a true story part of it where David Duke, who is head of the Klan, comes to Colorado Springs, and there's a whole storyline about that. But the way that it ends at the end, which doesn't give it away because it's the point, in Charlottesville, like with actual documentary footage of Charlottesville. So without, I don't think without mentioning Trump's name, it's very much directed towards right-wing politicians that use race and other things to maintain power. And apparently, you might have seen the same interview with Spike Lee. He said that he wanted to end it with Heather Heyer in Charlottesville being killed, but he phoned up Heather Heyer's mom to ask if that was okay, and she said, it's fine, put her in. So it ends with that. So in lots of ways, I thought I haven't seen that many films in theaters this year, but I thought by far that was the best one. And it does have a kind of a subtext of workers, police officers and workers, and internal, like there's a really racist cop who hates this primary character in the story. So it's sort of like, at least in the film, other workers supporting the black cop who's doing infiltration against the Klan. It's interesting in terms of how co-workers view each other within that framework. The other thing I was going to try to mention was you mentioned some jobs that you've had in the past, like call center stuff. Have you been in a union or done union organizing yourself?
I have been in a union. I have not done union organizing, but I was a union member when I was a cannery worker. It was the Teamsters Union. Right. And I've always supported unions, and not despite a very bad experience I had with the head of that union, a man who was really famous in Oregon, and violently grabbed my arm thinking I was leaving work inappropriately and left bruises on my arm.
Right.
He also called my sister little lady when she wanted to ask questions in a union meeting. Nonetheless, the value of unions in cannery work, when I worked on a farm as a cannery worker, I made a dollar something. When I worked in a unionized cannery, I made three something. So I definitely supported unions, and my mom had taught me not to cross picket lines, so I never have.
Yeah, at Portland State, we have a film program, and we've also done union support in terms of boycotts. So one of the films that we worked on and showed lately was, you probably saw it, it's called Mate One. It's an old John Sayles film about coal miners in West Virginia, true story.
No, I wish I had. Say the name of it again, just so I can
hear. Well, it's the name of the town in West Virginia, and it's almost a documentary. It's dramatization, but it's like almost incident, character, word for, it's called Mate One. It's the name of the town, M-A-T-E. W-A-N. It's okay. One of John Sayles. You may have heard of John Sayles.
Yeah, I have.
He's one of the. It's one of his first films. It has James Earl Jones. He plays the head of the Black Miners Union before he was Darth Vader. It has Chris Cooper, who plays a Wobbly, an IWW union organizer. Mm-hmm. And he gets. It's been criticized. I saw one review of Mate One saying, well, it's too idealistic because the Italian workers, the black workers, and the white poor Southern workers all unite together to form the union. They walk out at the same time, which is like one of the great moments in the film. It's like halfway through. What else was I going to say? Oh, I was going to ask you, too, if you have heard in the past overall about one of the boycotts that supported workers in Florida. You may have, specifically farm workers. It was a boycott against Taco Bell.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
and particularly because of the tomatoes, buying the tomatoes on cheap.
Well, it was supporting tomato workers who were mostly immigrants from El Salvador, Guatemala, Mexico, and Haiti. And I don't know if you've been a Portland State person or kept track of PSU stuff here and there, but we were the ninth college in the U.S. to kick Taco Bell off campus. We were
doing
a boycott for 2 years, and not because of that, but because there were nine schools and Taco Bell was at 100 colleges. The national boycott, which was Coalition of Immokalee Workers out of Florida, we brought them a couple times to PSU to talk. And basically Taco Bell, after we kicked them out, negotiated finally with CIW, and they finally got a pay raise, those workers, from the subcontractors through Taco Bell and that boycott. So overall, that was like a really successful pro-union organizing drive. And there were lots of ins and outs about how that worked, but it worked really well.
Lou.
Yeah, thanks for your help. Bye.
No, wait, stay, Lou. What I wanted to ask Lou, and we lost him, was how it made him feel to be part of those labor struggles. Because in my experience, becoming part of a struggle with fellow workers can be really, really enlivening. You can grow a ton from it. My brother was not particularly leftist, not particularly rightist, but he became a teacher. And as a teacher in the Denver area, they had a teacher strike. And I can't tell you how excited my brother was during that time. He was angry. He was furious. He was a union rep. But it really enlivened him, and he learned so much about the struggle between workers and the people that hold the money strings. And so I if you've ever been part of a strike, ever supported a strike or a workers' movement like that, I really encourage you to call in and tell us what your experience of that was. The last strike I remember specifically, a big one here, was the Fred Meyers and Safeway strike, the grocery workers. And that was that one we lost. Fred Meyers, I believe, spent $9 million to break that union, being willing to lose that much for the long-term goal of having the workers more at their behest and less empowered. That was many years ago, but we've had some interesting and important strikes and work going on here. I know Burgerville was one of the latest biggest ones. I've also heard, and if anyone has information about this, please feel free to call in. I'd like to hear that I believe the IWW is organizing in detention centers. So if you've heard that, let us know and call in. I think we do have one other caller. I'll throw out that number again for you who may not know it. It's 503-231-8187. Love to hear about your experiences with work. Edie, thanks for calling in. Good morning, Edie. We've got you on the line now.
Thank you so much. I was hoping that folks would be looking at what we can all do united to improve everybody's working conditions and pay and power. And that is, if we put an end to prison slavery or allow the folks, or require that if they're going to be doing the work, that they get paid family wage, full benefit pay, without the prison doing the same thing that company towns would do, which would dock you for all kinds of, you know.
Now, Edie, do you know that in our Constitution, I was shocked when I was first told this one of
the
Angola Three
Amendment. Yes, but it doesn't. But just because.
So let's finish that sentence for people who are listening. So what? Go ahead and you tell what that Fourth Amendment is.
14th Amendment says that there's the end of slavery except as punishment in prisons.
Yes. So that's
the
why.
The way in which we got more slavery after that than we had prior to the Civil War and during the plantation period. And remember, there were slaves up and down the Atlantic. It wasn't just in the so-called South. But right now, we have more slaves than ever before in the United States, and we could put an end to our race to the bottom if we have required minimal pay, benefits, and safe working conditions for all, and we would stop having the scapegoating of immigrant, refugee, asylum seekers, or people who are brown, because we would simply say, regardless, you're paid the same amount. So there'd be less of a reason for contractors like Trump put in, kind of gets hidden by folks, while he's bashing immigrants and talking about the wall, he had it, and I can't really give you the specific name right now, but he had it so that guest workers can come in from other countries and be even more exploited without any possibility of citizenship, so that in his construction projects, in the motels, the golf courses, et cetera, he can get workers even cheaper than ever before without any hope or protections under the former category. So if we simply say that no one is going to be at the bottom, then we don't have to be petted fighting against each other. And one of my happy union stories is that I am a very proud member of the SEIU, Service Employees International Union. And long before any of the other unions were involved with this, we were seeing the importance of inclusivity of languages, culture, races, national origin. And we were looking at international unionizing for those very people that are harder to digitize, mechanize, robotize, but or send offshore. People who are going to wipe your bottom, wipe your toilets, wipe your floors, and help in the hospital.
Caregivers and service workers is what you're talking about, yeah.
And colleges and universities, those who are not professors, et cetera. So we have a way in which we're united, and a good percentage of the people who are in nursing homes are immigrants, and a good percentage of those in home care, even more, are immigrants. And right now, through the 2000 election, we have the Oregon Home Care Commission that says that we get better value for our Medicaid dollar by having people have direct care in their home, where the person receiving the care, receiving Medicaid, with doctor and caseworker agreement on, you know, what are their needs, can be the boss, selecting, overseeing, firing, hiring those that meet the standards in the Oregon Home Care Commission and get better training than was ever provided in any other state, and the training is ever improving, and the certification, a registry referral,
yeah,
and
really
they get
important
union representation with SEIU, and so the care recipients and the caregivers and the taxpayers all benefit. So go to look at what SEIU is doing and support them. They're coming out for Joanne Hardesty and for the Portland Clean Energy Fund, you know, looking at housing and energy independence. So
okay, yeah, thank you for that, Edie.
At the bottom, and we don't fight among ourselves. Thank you so much. Goodbye.
Yeah, thank you, Edie. I really appreciate that. So that's SEIU she wants you to look at. And I know from my own experience that caregivers, many are immigrants. My sister's husband, my brother-in-law, died about a year ago. He had ALS, and so we had home care workers coming in. And there was one gentleman from Ethiopia, and I don't remember what his career had been, but he was a well-educated man. And he was completely interesting. The thing that was great for my sister and her husband was that they really loved to learn about other cultures and meet people from diverse cultures. And her husband was Hispanic, and so they had people from many different backgrounds and countries be caregivers, and they were really appreciative of it. And it was like a bonus. If you were going to have to be laying there suffering, you might as well have someone interesting to talk to and to learn from. Before we go to the next caller, and I'll throw out that number again, it's 503-231-8187. This is Labor Day. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund talking to you for KBOO for More Talk Radio. And we're telling stories this morning. We can get into statistics if you're interested. I have a few here. The gender gap, it's basically women make 80% of what men make. But when you go breaking it down racially, it turns out to be women of color make only about 50% of what a white man makes. So there are interesting statistics, but there's also interesting stories to be heard, and I want you to call in with those. So once again, it's 503-231-8187. I'll let you know what's coming up on KBOO. At 9, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour. It burrows down into the roots of the great issues of our time. I'm sure we'll hear about labor on that show. At 10 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein visits with the Sightline Institute to look at Tacoma, Washington, and that community's fight to stop fossil fuel development in the Northwest. That's been a really huge amount of activism in that area, and I'm so glad that she's up there and covering it for us. At 11, it's Economic Updates Labor Day Special with Richard Wolff talking about the exploding pay gap, the DNC's acceptance of fossil fuel donations, and capitalism versus socialism. And then at 11:30, it's Madness Radio interviews theoretical physicist Fritjof Capra about what the study of living systems can teach us about mental health care. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support, and I want to make sure you know that coming up on Thursday, we will be beginning our fall membership drive. We'd love to have you come in as a volunteer, work with us on that drive, and also certainly show your support with dollars and become a member or increase your membership. And so, do we have another person on the line? Pear?
Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Pear. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, well, let me tell you, I was in the San Francisco newspaper strike back in the late 60s.
Talk about that strike.
Well, I remember how it started. I was on a midnight till early morning shift, and the strike was supposed to start at midnight. So we came to work because we didn't know whether it'd be one or not. I was on the copy desk, and So we came to work, and at midnight we looked out the window, and if we saw any pickets out there, we weren't going to do any work. So that's what happened. We looked out the window, and there were pickets, so we just kind of sat down, and some management guys were trying to get the paper out. And at that time, newspapers were switching over to sort of computers and things like that, and these management guys are trying to stick down little sticky pieces of paper on these cardboard layouts. It was really kind of fun to watch them, you know. Anyway, that strike went on for quite a while. And what happened, this was TV station, KQED, they sort of created their own newspaper with some of the strikers. And it was like they had an editor, a guy named Mel Wax, and then they had different reporters would give their stories. And this is sort of the beginning of the kind of newspaper, TV news shows you have now, where you have sort of a guy who's sort of in charge, and you have different reporters.
Yeah, more the panel setting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's where it began. And I remember one thing, we had our strike kitchen with, we had a columnist named Bob Patterson, who knew everybody, kind of a con man in a way, but he was in charge of the strike kitchen. So we had our strike kitchen was meals contributed by all the great restaurants in San Francisco.
Oh, wow.
Trader Vic's and all these other places, you know. So the strike kitchen was really, it was quite a feast, and my wife was very jealous, so I brought her home.
You brought her home some of the food, yeah, I can imagine. You know, Pierre, did you find that being on strike for yourself and for your fellow workers was something that really made you grow, sort of expanded you and gave you new skills and new thoughts and...
Well, yeah. Well, I was always kind of radical anyway, you know, but so was some of the other people. We worked for Hearst Paper, but there's some really very lefty people on the copy desk and reporters. And
so what was the actual... Did you walk the picket line? Did you...
Well, we didn't. I was on... My picket shift was kind of early morning hours.
Ooh, I kind of like that.
Midnight till 6. Basically, it was we didn't have a picket line, but we had myself and a couple other people who kind of hang around between these two newspaper buildings in this alleyway, and we had a fire going in a big oil drum, you know, and we just kind of we were there with our signs, you know, we were kind of blocking that alleyway,
right.
But there was nothing really very much going
Did
on.
Did the papers bring in... Scabs? Scabs,
no.
People who haven't heard that phrase before used this way, scabs are those who will take the jobs of those who are on strike, those who had crossed the picket line.
Mm-hmm.
And often it could get, even up until through the 70s, get violent between the people on picket and the people trying to cross the strike, known as scabs.
Well, Jack London had a wonderful description, a definition of a scab. I wish I could repeat it from memory. But they didn't know the papers shut down, and strike went on for about 6 weeks, I think, and it was...
Was it in any way related to the strike that was at the Oregonian? That one was maybe earlier, in the early 50s.
I think that was. You know, I remember that... Some of the guys on the copy desk talked about that because the union here put out their own newspaper, and so people were making donations, you know, to keep that paper going. But I guess it didn't last, and so that strike was lost. And boy, I don't know. Of course, at that time, you had the Oregon Journal too.
Yeah, we had two newspapers.
Now the Oregonian is just kind of a hollow shell of itself.
For those of us who used to get two daily papers and they had a lot of substance in them, even though they had a political point of view that was not the same as mine, it is a disappointment not to have. Though we have, you know, I love Street Roots, I love Willamette Week, I love Mercury, and not each one of them for the same things, but I read all three of them to get different parts of news from here. Well, thank you, Pear, for talking about that strike. I appreciate it. I believe we have a strike going right now of teachers in Southern Washington. Two of them settled, and I think there's four more out. There's certainly been a wave of teachers coming forward since I think it was Georgia, where the teachers, or was it North Carolina where the teachers really went out, and Oklahoma where they went out. And so we're seeing teachers finally fighting back after so many years of being disparaged in the press and all the attempts. And in some states, it is illegal. I believe in Washington, they could shut down those strikes if the state wanted to go against the public, but there's so much public support that you're not going to see that. But anyone who wants to call in and talk about that strike or a part of the teacher strike going on or the victories they've won, please do call in with that. I know we have some other callers on the line. Brian, thanks for calling in, Brian.
Oh, hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, it's so hard to get all my thoughts together while I'm listening to these great stories. I hope what I have to offer is coherent. I had a lot of thoughts when I heard that your story is about labor today. And I had a little story to tell. I'm a musician and a farmer, and I had a funny story near the beginning of our farm. My wife was in town, and she was actually, one of her errands was to pay my union dues at the Musicians Union 99. And so she went in there, and they started talking to the woman in the office, and came around that me as a musician was funding the farm to keep it afloat.
Uh-huh.
And then she said, "Oh, that's interesting, a musician keeping the other half going," which is kind of an unusual
I think.
And
it's
then another little story that I had was, being a farmer, I've utilize the services of a small shop out in Boring called Red Pig Tools. He makes handmade tools for handwork and sells some awesome tools. And he is also a historian about farm labor and tools, like going back to the Roman times. He's a really interesting guy, Bob Denman. And a little shout out to Bob.
Yeah.
And he told me a story that he started out as a journalism major, I believe, in college, and his first job in California was as a reporter for a paper, I believe, and I hope I'm getting his story right, and he was covering the strikes, like Cesar Chavez,
uh-huh.
The strikes.
The grape strike.
And he said,
grape boycott.
I hope I'm putting him right, that the those first strikes started over a tool, and do you know about those?
No.
Okay, it started over a tool that was being used in the fields, that the big farms were making the Mexican workers use short-handled hoes, and they had to stoop over these short-handled hoes to weed the lettuce all day, and that meant that when the manager was looking out at the field and saw someone standing up straight, then they'd fire them.
Oh, my.
That's how they kept,
yeah, you know,
kept working, is they had to bend over to use these short-handled hose. And, man, talk about evil.
Well, and as a farmer, you know how hard field work can be. I did a little field work. I have a many varied background. When I moved to back into Oregon, I had been in Oklahoma for my mother's master's degree. We moved into Salem, and she had three teenage kids and moved in early summer, and she didn't want us being bad teenage kids, and so she said we all had to work in the fields. And in those days, and this was like, let's see, 1964, buses would come around, and I know they did that here in the city. Buses would come around and just be on any corner at about 5 a.m, as I recall, and I actually love that early morning time. I love the way the air feels, especially in the summer. It's still cool, and the smells are all coming up. So I remember how much I loved being there at that time. But, boy, we went out to strawberry fields, and it was brutal. And I was terrible at it.
I didn't get to do that, and I have so many friends. They grew up around here and would go work on pick beans and strawberries up near the Columbia, what is, I guess, Rose City, whatever area now.
Yeah, there's a lot of farms still there, agricultural farms.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, that's such a mixed thing. I mean, I believe in labor laws, and I believe in not abusing children, but everyone I talk to, even though they might say, oh boy, that sure was hard, they got so much out of it, and I think it's a shame that there isn't some flexibility to allow that more now. But I had one thing that I wanted to address before
sure.
I know we got to move on to other people. Being a farmer, small, organic, trying to be sustainable farmer, I'm a supporter of KBOO, and I listen to the shows about minimum wage and labor rights. But I don't understand, and I call in once in a while, and basically the response I get from the host is like, oh, yeah, that's a shame the way things are. That's as far as, you know, people think about it. But small local organic farms, as the minimum wage goes up, I don't know how they're going to survive. I don't know how we're going to survive as a farm, because in all the years, you know, so many of us farmers that own the farms or that run the farms are doing it out of a passion for local sustainable food and feel like there's no other choice than to go in that direction, yet the system is working against us. And then, like, minimum wage laws are working against us. If my wife and I made minimum wage, we'd be fabulously wealthy, because we work all the time and make far less than all the people that work for us.
Yeah.
So it'd be nice to have a show at some point that addressed that particular thing. I don't know how we're going to survive as small local farmers as the minimum wage climbs so much higher than we ever make ourselves.
I hear what you're saying, Brian, and I know that's actually true. And it makes my mind go to, is there any way we could collectivize the workers who work on your farms with you in a way that maybe the benefits wouldn't be higher wages, but maybe it could be somehow in kind, or, I don't know, sharing the burden some way? It's a really hard question you're asking, because it's an important question.
A lot of the farmers, of the young people, when you can find people that are willing to do this kind of thing, which is really hard mentally and physically, they would like to do it, to learn, to gain experience. But in our system, unless it's some official apprentice program, which are very rare, there's the Rogue Farm Corps, shout out to Rogue Farm Corps, but there's very rare, but a lot of people would like to work on a farm and get experience and are willing to make less, but the system doesn't allow it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that point of view. I'm going to bring up another one now that you're talking about that, which was that, not another one, but in contrast to that, why the laws are important is that when I worked in I mentioned earlier, when I was union cannery, I made $3 something. Believe it or not, that was a great wage at that time, helped me pay my college. But when I worked on I think it was Western Mushroom Farms, I'm not sure if that was the name of it, in Salem, out in the country, and because it was a cannery on a farm, it was farm labor, and they weren't required to pay same kind of minimum wages. And they really quite took advantage of the fact that they ran their cannery anywhere from 8 hours to 10 hours to 12 hours, and you would not know in advance, and they would not let you know in advance when you were going to get off. For many of the workers, they had someone having to come and pick them up, and we were like 20 miles outside of town. They also, what I found out just by happenstance, was all of the workers in the cannery, which was wet and cold, and we were putting little mushrooms on these round things to have the caps pulled off. I actually began dreaming of mushrooms that way. I worked that one. And the water would go on. They'd come bubbling down on water and get your feet all wet. So it wasn't great working conditions at all. And, you know, couple breaks and then too much for, you know, no more for you. But one day I was walking out a back door from the cannery and heading over to where I was going to be picked up by my mother. I think I was 17 at the time, and I saw where they grew the mushrooms, and there were these huge barns that went from the ground, you know, like up at least 50 feet. And when you looked inside, they were pitch dark, and the workers who worked in there wore miner's caps, and they had, I'll call them cherry ladders, these ladders that the cherry growers use, which are just a simple ladder with no backstand, just one thing that leans up against the trees. They would use ladders like that leaned up against the walls, which had trays and trays or shelves and shelves of mushroom going all the way up to the top of the roof. And so these women would work climbing up those high ladders in the dark. And all of the women in those barns were women of color. And so there you saw, you know, farm labor not regulated in a way it should. So the very worst jobs, and I'm sure they paid them lower, though I don't have any proof of that, were reserved for the women of color. And
why did they go up the walls? So why did they use the heights like that?
I don't know. Maybe it was just to stack, you know, maybe it was maximizing the growing space by, you know, these trays going up walls. I don't really know.
Oh boy, that's some dangerous working
conditions. Yeah, and just, you know, yeah.
But
so we need to protect farm labor and protect
the produce that, you know, it didn't just grow in the store. There's so much behind it, and I wish more and more people, and more people are, but it's a slow process to understand what goes into that food they eat.
Well, and I think here in all the western states and all the southern states where we're doing, you know, where there's agriculture, we need to really support our immigrant workers because they're how we get food on the table. Well, I'm going to let you go. Thank you so much for calling in with your experience. We've got a couple more callers.
Thank
I'll
you.
Try to get you in before the end of the morning. Good morning. I have Steve on the line. Steve.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Fellow berry picker.
Berry picker, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, way back when.
Was that your first job?
Yeah, probably sixth grade, fifth grade.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Very hard, isn't it? It's hard work. It's hard on the back.
You know, God gave me a strong back, but not a lot of brain. So it worked really well for me. Yeah. But, yeah, I was kind of talking about unions. I worked at United Grocers, a warehouse there, for about 5 years back in the 80s.
Uh-huh, as a warehouseman?
Yeah. Yeah, and we were Teamsters back then.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I really liked the pay. It was really good money back in the day. But, you know, the controversial, everything that went on with the unions and everything, I think it's one of the reasons it caused me. I'm out of breath a little bit. I'm actually working today.
Oh, yeah. Are you saying the controversies when we began to have union leaders corrupt?
Union, you know, everything that goes up with the tension, you know, in the grocery industry, it was the tension was unbelievable between the unions, the upper management, employees, you know, even when everything was going good. And I think one of the reasons I became self-employed. I've been self-employed the rest of my life, but
you want to kind of get out of that fray?
Yeah, you know, we had about 50 guys on our shift, and you could just see some guys that had been there 10, 15 years that it took a toll on them.
Mm-hmm.
That environment, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
And all Teamsters have that, but in the grocery industry, it wasn't real good.
Well, and I don't know about you, but, you know, you felt like the Teamsters were supposed to be on your side, but they didn't necessarily always act like it, did they?
Well, yeah, and I think it just comes with the territory. You know, it's part of the thing. I don't think it's ever going to be a really good environment.
No, there's always there's definitely going to be tension. You know, I think I'll bring this in before we go to the next caller. I want to say the future of labor is in doubt. If you haven't heard about 3D printing and the manufacturing of incredible things with just these 3D printers and the lack of labor needed to do that, that should give you pause. I also talked to a long-haul truck driver. Shout out to John McVeigh if you're out there somewhere listening this morning. I know he's a KBOO listener. He told me about this brewery he goes to. This it's really just a bottling plant for everything from Pabst Blue Ribbon to you know, think of every cheap brand, like six or seven cheap brands of beer you can. And he said this cannery was huge, just, you know, like acres and acres and acres and acres, not cannery, this facility. And you would go up and back up, and everything was automated. It was like less than, you know, like 20 workers in the whole place. Something that would have in the past taken hundreds of workers. And so I think we're going to see in the future, what is the future of labor? And if we're not needed by those who have the money, the top 1%, and believe me, the wage gap is huge between us and the top, the income gap, then if they don't need us, they don't want to pay for us, and clearly all of our benefits and those kinds of things have been going down as the right has grown stronger and the wage disparity has grown much, what are we going to do and what's going to happen to us? So I think that's a question for our future. But thank you for calling in this morning. I believe we have one more caller on the line. Harry, we've got like a minute and a half for you. So
okay, I also started my work history picking berries.
Yeah.
I lived out here in outer southeast Portland between Portland and Gresham. And at the time in the 70s, they would bring buses to the school that you went to at 6 o'clock in the morning. And then they brought you back at 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And, My very first job was Mr. Burger on 42nd and Killingsworth, but that was just part-time during high school. But I also had a job at Fred Meyer, and that had a union, and I worked my way from box boy to checker, and at that time, I was making more money than my parents.
Wow.
Yeah.
That felt pretty good, huh?
Yeah, but the issue with the Fred Meyer was they only hired part-time part-time, so it was seasonal. After January 1st, after New Year's, things dropped off, and if you didn't get more than 25 hours, you weren't covered by the insurance.
Same with cannery workers. It's seasonal, and so some of them might start earlier in the spring than others and go later into the, maybe all the way up to November or December, but that was it. Because the, you know, the crops weren't there. So people tried to work as hard and as long. I remember working, I believe it was 71 days straight and then one day off. But, you know, that's how I made my way through college. So, you know, with seasonal jobs, people try to put everything into that season.
Yeah.
You know, we're running out of time. I want to thank all of you who have called in this morning. This is Linda Olson Osterlund for More Talk Radio. We are now going to go on to the Old Mole Variety Hour. And once again, thank you to all of you for being part of KBOO and making a difference with your voices.
In celebration of our 50th anniversary, KBOO is teaming up with the Mississippi Records Music and Film Series. KBOO will be hosting Coal Miner's Daughter on Wednesday, September 5th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. This film from 1980 chronicles the life of country singer Loretta Lynn. Sissy Spacek brings sincerity and depth to her portrait of Loretta and does her own singing in the movie, as does Beverly D'Angelo in the role of Patsy Cline. Tommy Lee Jones also delivers one of his best performances. Again, that's Coal Miner's Daughter on Wednesday, September 5th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, I was born a coal miner's daughter.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 13th annual Dancing in the Square American Indian Day Celebration Powwow on Friday, September 7th from noon to 7 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square in Portland. American Indian Day is a traditional showcase in celebration of American Indian and Alaskan Native cultures and community, which raises awareness concerning the challenges that Native American people face in this country. This event features vendors, educational booths, food, entertainment, and more. Again, that's Dancing in the Square American Indian Day Celebration Powwow on Friday, September 7th from noon to 7 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square, 700 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and it's just 1 minute after 9 o'clock. KBOO programming is made possible by